Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Since we don't have a program on Sunday, today's program is devoted entirely to the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. Guests today include Garrett Graff, former editor of Politico magazine and Washingtonian magazine. Garrett wrote a fascinating article in Politico magazine that was published today. And it's an extensive look about the events from the perspective of Air Force One during 9/11. It's a fascinating piece because what it does, it takes the view of those people that were on the plane, around the plane, traveling with the president, those that were at places where the president's plane landed, and also the fighter pilots who escorted the plane. Really looking forward to this, and I think you will enjoy it too. And then Brandon Del Pozo, the chief of police in Burlington. But at the time of 9/11, a New York City police officer, and in downtown Manhattan that day, and then former Lieutenant Governor Brian Doobie, who was on duty as an American Airline pilot on 9/11, but quickly changed roles, and was directly involved in the recovery efforts at Ground Zero. How he describes what it was like at Ground Zero is simply amazing. Plus, towards the end of the program, your phone calls about your experience on September 11, 2001. Just wanted to take a few minutes and sort of reflect and share with you some of the thoughts about 9/11. I mean, what can you say about it? There are occasions in our lives where events change our lives. The birth of a child, for example, is life-changing. But certain transformative events, certain of them, we can share collectively as a nation. And we've done it in the past. Tom Beardsley earlier had mentioned the assassination of JFK. For an earlier generation, it may have been Pearl Harbor. But September 11th, 2001 was a transformative event for all of us who witnessed the horrors of that day and the aftermath that followed. We knew on that morning, on that tragic morning, we knew that our lives were going to change. We knew that when we saw 19 terrorists hijack 4 commercial passenger jets and then crash them into the Twin Towers at the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and into the ground just outside Shanksville, Pennsylvania, change was coming. We didn't know what it would be, but we know our lives would change. So on Sunday, we marked the 15th anniversary of September 11th terrorist attacks. A day, think about this, a day where almost 3,000 people were killed and over 6,000 people injured. And what did we try to do? We tried to return to our normal lives after the attack. But what did we discover? Normal was never the same. We watched our kids. I remember I was at Harwood Union High School, and I was watching a cross-country meet. And I looked up in the sky, and not what was different was sort of the silence. Not a single commercial airline was flying. They were all grounded. And when you did see one, the contrails of a aircraft, it was often this large military aircraft designed to sort of refuel other planes in midair. And if you were in Chittenden County, you could hear the roar of fighter jets taking off and landing at the Burlington International Airport. But it was in between the roar that it was just eerily silent. But as we watched our TV screens, it was the pile of that burning rubble in New York City, where the two towers, the twin towers, used to stand, that haunted us. You probably remember it well. When we saw the destruction, we became acutely aware of just how vulnerable we were to attacks. We didn't know that before. But that day on, we did. And when we viewed that rubble, it also heightened our anger at those that did this to us. I remember we prayed for the victims. We wept for those that were in pain. We hugged those that were safe. And we praised the heroes of that day. And there were many heroes, especially our first responders, but also those passengers on United Flight 93. That was the flight that flew into the ground at Shanksville, Pennsylvania. They tried to take back that aircraft. They knew that hijacked airliner was headed to D.C., either the Capitol or the White House. And they tried to rush the cockpit and take back that aircraft. That aircraft crashed in Pennsylvania. But undoubtedly, they saved hundreds, if not thousands, of lives with their heroic efforts. And you think about the changes. I mean, new laws were passed in order to protect us. The United States began surveillance operations that snooped not only on enemies, but as we found out later, on everyday citizens. At airports, where we probably saw the most change, was beefed up security that resulted in all things being banned from aircrafts. We had to even change the bottles in which we brought shampoo, soap, those sort of things. And if you've been through an airport lately, we installed full body scanners and incorporated them in our screening process. Armed air marshals were deployed, and they boarded random flights, and that provided enhanced security. We went to war, first in Afghanistan and then in Iraq. And although our military victory seemed decisive, especially at the outset, guess what? We're still at war. Peace has been elusive for 15 years. You know, as a country, we've done much in hopes of protecting Americans. And as I just described, much has changed in this country in pursuit of our safety after 9/11. But what is the question we still ask the most? What is the question that we think of when we're talking about terrorism? Are we safer? And depending who you talk to, you'll get various response. But by most accounts, we are safer. But this is important. We're not entirely safe. And if you let me venture just a moment away from this to presidential politics, this year's presidential politics, isn't how you define and achieve safety a fundamental issue in this year's presidential election? For example, Donald Trump sees safety as limiting immigration, building up and projecting American military power throughout the world, Hillary Clinton's foreign military policy is more constrained, less confrontational, and less restrictive in immigration. But I digress for a minute on that. What I really want to focus on is how do we remember this? How do we remember this event? We're going to be talking with people today that have either written or been involved in this event. So how do we remember the single deadliest terror attack in history? And of course, it's important, as we just did, reflecting on the past or pondering what our future is going to be, whether through presidential politics or other. And we're uncertain about that. But most of the reflections, in my opinion, on Sunday should be remembering those that died in these attacks. And we can't forget those also that have been killed in the conflicts as a result of 9/11. The greatest respect we can give these victims is in the simple act of remembering them. Coming up, Garrett Graff with his piece today in Politico magazine. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my great pleasure to have on the Open Mic program this morning Garrett Graff, former editor of Politico magazine. Garrett, good morning.
Good morning. Pleasure to be back.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Garrett, your piece appearing in Politico magazine today is entitled "We're the Only Plane in the Sky." This is an extensive article about what was happening in and around Air Force One on 9/11. Can you explain what you had to do to put this article together?
So this is a story that I've been interested in for a number of years, and thought the 15th anniversary of 9/11 was a great opportunity to do it. But no one has ever really told the story or explored the story of what was happening to President Bush aboard Air Force One. It was this very strange moment. The president was on this routine trip that we all remember. He was reading with school children in the Emma Booker Elementary School in Sarasota, Florida. And Andy Card comes in, whispers in his ear, and says, "America is under attack." And from that point forward, there are these two competing pressures in the presidency. The need to protect the office of the presidency, what's called continuity of government, and then the president's desire to reassure a nation that he was in charge and that the government was functioning. And so what ended up happening was the Secret Service rushed the president back to Air Force One on the tarmac in Sarasota and took him up into the sky. And for the next 8 hours, he traversed the eastern half of the United States, going first to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana, and then on to Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, and finally back to Washington at the end of the day, once everyone had determined it was safe. And I was fascinated in what happened, what transpired during those 8 hours in the air. So I went back, and I spent the last couple of weeks interviewing about two dozen of the people who were on board, about 40 hours of interviews altogether, and have put together this piece, as you say. The title is from one of the quotes someone gave me, "We're the only plane in the sky," and pulling together all of these viewpoints about what life was like for the 65 people who were on board Air Force One.
What I found fascinating, Garrett, is that it's not a typical article. Basically, what you've done is taken pieces of the interviews from various people and placed them so that it reads almost, I got to admit, almost like a novel, but it's real life that we're talking about. These extensive interviews that you did, was it difficult to round up everyone?
Yeah, because part of what was challenging is that day was so ad hoc that many of the people who would normally travel with President Bush weren't traveling with him that day. And so it was this group of people who were not his normal aides, who were not even necessarily his normal crew. One of the weird pieces of history that I uncovered in reporting for this was that September 11th was actually at the same time Ronald Reagan's Air Force One, which was a Boeing 707 that had been retired by the U.S. Air Force, was actually being delivered to the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library that weekend. And so much of the normal Air Force One crew was actually out in California with Ronald Reagan's retired Air Force plane. And so the people who were aboard Air Force One that day were a lot of second in command. They were, and even among the president's top aides, you had Dan Bartlett on board instead of Karen Hughes, who would have normally traveled. The president's personal aide, Blake Gottesman, it was actually his first day on the job. He was filling in for the president's normal personal aide, who was in the hospital that day. And there were all of these people who sort of shouldn't have been on board that day, but happened to be there and are now part of history.
What I was struck by when I was reading your article was the confusion that surrounded what was happening. And I guess we've been sort of, the movies have affected us, because when we think of Air Force One, we think that it's got all the communication capabilities of the world at its disposal. And yet, when they came from that school, and I want to describe that scene from that school in just a minute, because it was sort of chaotic, it was sort of rushed. But when they got aboard Air Force One, they had the same sort of trouble finding out information that we did.
Well, and actually it's even weirder than that, because for the most part, the president and those aboard Air Force One on 9/11 knew less than the average American. Because, you know, all of us who lived through that day, we were riveted to our television sets. You know, we spent that entire day just watching these moments unfold in over the course of the day, you know, one tragedy after another. But Air Force One didn't have satellite television at that point. And so they were only able to watch television when they were flying over a major urban area, and they basically could pick up the equivalent of rabbit ears and watch a local TV affiliate for a little bit. And so it wasn't until hours later that the president actually saw on a replay the towers fall. I mean, think of that. Like, think of how, you know, the whole rest of the country has watched this happen live 3 hours earlier, and here you are, the commander-in-chief, sitting there, you know, after lunchtime, seeing it for the first time.
You know, one of the things we often think about, and I want to sort of go chronologically through the day, but one thing that struck me as I was reading your article, and the article is in Politico magazine today, it's called "We're the Only Plane in the Sky," and we're speaking with Garrett Graff, former editor of Politico magazine. One of the things that struck me was that presidents don't always get what they want. And one of the things that happened, there was a theme throughout your article, there were pretty heated discussions about getting back to Washington. The president wanted to get back to Washington, and he was being overruled on several occasions on that desire.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for those of us who were watching, we remember Peter Jennings and Brian Williams and the other TV anchors just blasting President Bush through that day. It's, you know, where's the president? Why isn't he in charge? Why isn't he in control at the White House? You know, why is he fleeing across the country away from Washington? And, you know, this was obviously a theme that was very much a part of Michael Moore's documentary Fahrenheit 9/11 that came out years later. And it solidified this idea that the president was actually scared that day. And what I found is actually quite the opposite, that the president from the first moment, literally from his first comment in Sarasota, Florida that morning, was saying, I got to get back to Washington. I got to show people that, you know, we're in charge and we're not afraid. But you have this competing interest from the Secret Service and the military, whose job it is to keep the president safe, and that they have what they see as a duty not to the man but to the nation, that they have a duty to protect the constitutionally elected commander in chief, chosen by the American people, and that they need to keep him alive. And so you have these multiple moments playing out over the first half of the day where the president said, I want to go back to Washington, and you had the military, you had the Secret Service, you had his White House Chief of Staff say, you know, I'm sorry, Mr. President, we can't do that. We need to keep you safe. And, you know, there's one quote in there where the pilot of Air Force One says, I don't care what he says, I'm in charge of this plane. And, you know, just imagine if you are an Air Force colonel and you have your commander-in-chief giving you an order to fly the plane back to Washington, and you're saying, you know, I'm sorry, sir, I have another obligation to the American people beyond what your own personal desire is.
So let's start in Sarasota, Florida, when the news came that a plane hit a tower at the World Trade Center. What was the prevalent feeling at the time that was happening? Take us back to the sort of off stage. The president was on stage with kids, but off stage, what was happening?
Off stage, you had all of these things beginning to turn into action. So, because remember, at the start, we didn't necessarily understand that the president was going to, we didn't necessarily understand that this was a terrorist attack. The first reports were that this was a small plane that had hit the World Trade Center, a twin-engine prop plane, and no one really understood that this was a terrorist attack at that point. And it really wasn't until that second plane hit that people realized that this was going to be a terrorist attack. And so you had the White House and the Situation Room and the Secret Service and the crew aboard Air Force One trying to figure out what to do. And then the moment that they realized that this indeed was a terrorist attack, they started to turn into action. But even at that point, remember, we all thought that this was just an attack on New York. So they weren't necessarily concerned for the president's safety. They were concerned about the need to have the president be in a position to provide help to New York City when this was a terrorist attack. But then the Pentagon got hit, and that was when they realized that this was a multifaceted terrorist attack. And that was when they began to become concerned for the president and decided to evacuate him and put him into the only place at the time where anyone thought he would be safe, which was up in the air, 45,000 feet, 8 miles above the above America. And let's, as the pilot said at one point, let's just go cruise around the Gulf of Mexico for a little while until we figure things out.
And I want you to describe, because everybody knew at this point things had changed, because Andy Card obviously came up. It's fame, you know, it's infamous now, and seeing it on TV, Andy Card, chief of staff of the president, came up, whispered in his ear, Mr. President, we're under attack. But after that, when he left that school, it was a hurried trip back to Air Force One. And I'd like you to describe what Air Force One was like, according to the people, in taking off from Sarasota, because it was not a normal takeoff.
it was not a normal takeoff at all. And what you had was the moment that the motorcade came up, the engines on Air Force One were already running, which is normally a no-no. And they got the president aboard. They hustled him aboard. And as Andy Card said, they were the plane was rolling basically before even the president was in the suite. And I didn't get into this in the story, but I can give it as an exclusive detail for WDEV listeners this morning. But they were concerned, actually, on the ground in Sarasota, because there was a group of people gathering outside the gates of the airport at one end of the runway. And Air Force One was the pilot and the Secret Service were concerned that there might be someone there with a surface-to-air missile, a Stinger missile, targeting the plane as it took off. And so they took off in the other direction, and they took off sort of more steeply and more aggressively and more quickly than any commercial aircraft has ever taken off before. And as someone on board said, it felt like a roller coaster. The nose was up, the tail was down, and we just went straight up.
One of the things that you had mentioned, the pilot said they were headed towards DC, but then they sort of decided that at that point they would sort of cruise around the Gulf of Mexico. One of the things that people don't know, at this point there were no fighter escorts. There was no protection for Air Force One, and there were still aircraft in the air. Is that right?
There were two aircraft actually just around Sarasota that the FAA and the Air Force was concerned about. They thought one plane might be trying to attack Air Force One, headed towards Air Force One, without its identification on, and it wasn't responding to the radio. And then they were beginning to fly back towards Washington, and the plan was actually to drop the president at Camp David, where he would be about an hour outside the Capitol and could return to the Capitol as soon as everything was safe and secure. But that was right when Flight 93 crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And the first report of that, Shanksville is not particularly far from Camp David, which we now understand is entirely a coincidence. But the first reports of that was that a plane had crashed near Camp David. And so that was the first part where they said, okay, well, we don't want to bring the president back to Washington yet. There's too much chaos going on. And then a second thing happened. And this is one of the most interesting moments of the day, because it was a complete, as they say, fog of war moment. It didn't actually ever happen, but came to impact 9/11 in a very big way, where someone reported at the White House a threat had been called in to Air Force One. And what the threat was, and this was only determined literally months later, that people sort of traced how this game of telephone unfolded. The threat said, something like, Air Force One is next. Mm-hmm. Well, Air Force One in the military is known by a classified code name, and the code name is Angel. That has been the code name for the airplane for decades. I mean, dating all the way back to when John F. Kennedy first began to have a plane that was known as Air Force One. And the way that in the White House Situation Room that threat was passed along was a military staffer translated that into military speak and said, instead of saying the threat said Air Force One is next, they passed it along and said, a caller to the White House switchboard reported that Angel is next. And that was how the vice president relayed that threat to the plane. And the Secret Service and the Air Force crew aboard were very concerned about this. They thought that that there was someone, that there was a terrorist out there, a plotter, who knew Air Force One's code name and was sufficiently clued in and perhaps even an insider that was targeting the plane. And so they began to take evasive action in the air. And for the first and only time, the Air Force actually put an armed security guard outside the cockpit of Air Force One to prevent anyone on the plane from trying to get into the cockpit.
And that's, Garrett, that's what I found fascinating when I was reading this and that portion of it, because they didn't know if they had somebody on the plane that may be involved in these attacks.
Exactly. And this was actually part of what we now understand as, remember, this actually was just 3 years after, or 4 years after, that Harrison Ford movie, Air Force One, about a terrorist plot to take over the president's airliner. And as far-fetched as that movie was, that was something that on that day, on September 11th, 2001, the Secret Service and the Air Force were concerned about. And that was in part because, as I was explaining earlier, there were so many people on board that day who were not normally part of the Air Force One traveling party. And so they were like, yeah, we know who Andy Card is. We know who, Karl Rove and Ari Fleischer are. But a lot of the press were people that they didn't know particularly well. There were even some White House staff and some Air Force crew that they didn't know particularly well. And they were, as one of the security guards said to me, they have such absolute control over the plane that it's not that they're worried that there's some stowaway hidden in the bathroom with an AK-47. They know everyone on the plane is supposed to be on the plane, but you don't know what those people who are supposed to be on the plane might be thinking, what their real motivations that day might be.
When the plane took off from Sarasota, one of the things that happened was the president got in touch with the vice president, and the order that he gave, which seemed to be an order that upset him a lot, was the fact that he gave the order to shoot down commercial aircraft that may be hijacked. When United Flight 93 went down, they thought on the plane that it had been shot down.
We've talked about this a couple of times already this morning, just the sheer confusion of that day. I mean, there were reports of a car bomb that had gone off at the State Department, which I think we all remember that day. I remember it vividly. And there was a report of a hijacked plane on its way to the president's ranch in Crawford, Texas. There were, there was at one point the fear that there were as many as 20 or 24 planes hijacked that day. And so the president was talking to Vice President Cheney, and what we now understand, and I don't really get into this in the piece, but just for historical reference, we now understand that what we think actually happened was that the vice president first gave the authorization to shoot down airliners right around maybe 10:15 that morning. And then only later, actually, when he was able to finally reach the president because of those communication challenges that we discussed, he passed that along, asked the president to affirm that authorization, which the president did. But it was right around then that they began to hear both at the White House and on Air Force One about Flight 93 crashing in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Now, it was after, though, Dick Cheney and President Bush had discussed shooting down hijacked airliners. And so they thought they had shot that plane down. Mm-hmm. And they thought well until about 1 or 2 o'clock that afternoon that we had shot that plane down.
Garrett, when we come back,
It was only hours later that we came to understand that that plane had actually crashed before any fighters could get to it, and it was in fact only literally years later did we figure out that Vice President Cheney probably gave the order to shoot the planes down before he was actually able to talk to President Bush.
Mm-hmm. When we come back, let's roll through the rest of the day to Barksdale Air Force Base and Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, and then the return to Washington. We're speaking with Garrett Graff, who has a fascinating piece in Politico magazine this morning about Air Force One and that day. We'll return in just a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Garrett Graff, who's written a fascinating piece for Politico magazine entitled "We're the Only Plane in the Sky," and it's about that day on 9/11 and what was going on Air Force One. And Garrett, where we left off is Air Force One is sort of cruising the skies now at 45,000 feet, and the decision was to go to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. Why did they decide to go there?
They needed, they had too many people on board, was the first issue. They were all of the people who were supposed to be on board for that routine flight, and they wanted to offload a bunch of passengers. They also were running low on fuel. They had only put enough fuel aboard the plane for the routine flight back to Washington, and so they were concerned that they, particularly once they began to circle a little bit over the Gulf of Mexico and figure things out, that they didn't have enough fuel for the day. And then they needed somewhere that was going to be secure. Barksdale Air Force Base, and actually the whole U.S. nuclear command, happened to be on a routine exercise that day on September 11th called Global Guardian. And so Barksdale was already under a practice alert, and they took Air Force One into Barksdale to try to figure out what to do in the rest of the day. And they landed, and they realized at that moment that they had just brought him to a base absolutely packed with nuclear weapons, that they all of the base's B-52s were sitting there, the bombers lined up along the runway, wingtip to wingtip, and all of them were carrying live nuclear weapons as part of this exercise. But luckily, there was very tight security around the base because of all of those nuclear weapons, and the president was able to get his first briefing, and they were able to refuel the plane, because at that point, the Secret Service and the Air Force thought it was possible that Air Force One might be gone for days. I mean, they literally thought it might be 2 or 3 days of flying around the country, taking the president to undisclosed locations before it would be safe to return to Washington and the White House.
So they've refueled, and there was a fascinating little story in that refueling effort, in that there was a tech sergeant, I think, that decided that they were going to, there was a civilian who didn't want to break into these reserve fuel areas, and this tech sergeant decided that we're going to break into those.
Yeah, they were trying to refuel the plane, and they had the crew was beginning to try to do it like one tiny fuel tank or fuel truck at a time. But then they do have these massive, what they call hot refueling tanks for bombers in wartime. And the Air Force started to try to use one, and some of the civilian staff stopped them and said, we can't use these. These are for wartime only. And there's this Air Force sergeant who was standing by the plane who overhears this and bellows, "We are at war," and pulls out his knife and rips off the covering of the refueling tanks. And Air Force One is filled up with 150,000 pounds, 14 hours worth of fuel.
They decide to take off again, and this time they head for Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska. Why did they decide to go there?
So this is, again, one of those fascinating moments about just how much the world has changed in 15 years. So Karl Rove, who was one of the people I interviewed for the article, was explaining to me how today the president travels with a briefcase made by Halliburton that can plug into any internet connection in the world and be able to conduct a video teleconference with anyone that he wants. But in 2001, when the president wanted to hold a video teleconference with the nation's top leaders spread across the country as they were, the only place he could do that outside of Washington, D.C. was off at Air Force Base. The head of U.S. Strategic Command, our nuclear command, and so they ended up flying to off at Air Force Base outside Omaha, Nebraska, and I actually got to go there about 2.5 weeks ago to see the base and to see where the president went and the bunker that they took him down into. And he spent the early part of that afternoon of September 11th in the bunker at Offutt, about 4, 5, 6 stories underground. And then once the airspace was entirely clear and they cleared the last worrisome plane out of the sky, the last unidentified commercial airliner that day, the president said, now it's time to go home. Mm-hmm. And they got the plane ready, and the president raced back, and they took off. And one of the sort of funny moments of the day was they were in such a hurry to leave, no one remembered to tell the fighter escort. So the fighter planes are sitting there on the runway at Offutt, and they see Air Force One take off, and they're like, oh shoot, we've got to get going. And they take off, and the amazing thing is Air Force One at that point was flying so fast, almost the speed of sound, that the fighter jets had to ask it to slow down over Ohio so that the fighters could catch up.
The decision to go back to Washington, the one of the things, just before we leave off at Air Force Base, one of the things that was there, though, was the ability to communicate in sort of clear terms. We have about 5 minutes left, so I want to get to Washington. But that was sort of the first, reading your article, that was sort of the first time they had the communication capabilities to communicate with CIA, with everybody that they needed to communicate with.
Yes, and so that's the first time that the president is made aware of the intelligence that the CIA has gathered at that point, and the FBI has gathered, that shows that this was probably Al-Qaeda and probably Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. Although that had been suspected all day long. And Andy Card, the White House chief of staff, told me that actually the moment that they realized it was a terrorist attack, that his mind went to, as he says, the three initials, UBL, which is the government's moniker for Osama bin Laden. And then Mike Morrell, who was the president's CIA briefer that day, who was on board Air Force One, actually went on to become the acting director of the CIA twice at the top of the agency later on. His immediate thought that day on the plane, his personal opinion, he explained to the president he had no reason, he had no intelligence backing this up, but his personal opinion was that it was going to be Al-Qaeda.
One of the things that I didn't expect to go here, but quickly, I do want to go here. Mike Morrell felt that he let the president down. I didn't understand that in the article. Why did he feel he let the president down? And again, we've got about three minutes, actually.
Because the president was so desperate for information that day that he had asked Mike Morrell to tell him basically in real time if CIA found any information about the CIA, about who did it. And the president was very annoyed when he got to Offutt Air Force Base and got to that video teleconference and discovered that CIA had actually gathered a large amount of information about who did it, and actually knew even some of the names of the hijackers, and that the names of those hijackers were linked to al-Qaeda. And the president was just momentarily very angry with Mike Morrell because he felt that CIA had been hiding information from him that day.
Let me go right to your thoughts on this. What was your takeaway from writing the article? We've got about a minute left.
The thing that I was really fascinated by was this tension of the president wanting to return and show that he was in charge, and the people around the president wanting to protect the president. That, you know, there, I think there really is this misunderstood narrative that the president spent the day running away from Washington. But in the end, that's actually exactly what all of the nation's emergency plans call for, is the president is supposed to be spirited away. He is supposed to be kept safe. And that the presidency itself is actually much more important than the man, or perhaps come January, woman, who holds that office. And that the first obligation of the military and the Secret Service is to the office and the American people. And that's why they kept President Bush away all day.
Garrett Graff, thank you so much for your fascinating article. It's called "We're the Only Plane in the Sky," and you can go online and read it on in Politico magazine this morning. Garrett, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Looking forward to the rest of the show.
Well, thank you, Garrett. That's Garrett Graff, former editor of Politico magazine. Coming up, we'll speak with Brandon Del Pozo, chief now of the Burlington Police Department. But he was a New York City police officer in Lower Manhattan on 9/11. And then, of course, former Lieutenant Governor Brian Doobie and his efforts at the recovery effort at Ground Zero. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And, of course, we're always streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. I'll be right back. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. I want to remind everybody that the program today is dedicated to 9/11/2001. We don't broadcast on Sunday, so we have dedicated today to talking about 9/11/2001. And just a while ago, we had a fascinating interview with Garrett Graff of Politico magazine. He wrote a fascinating, well, he's not of Politico. He's the former editor of Politico magazine. He now writes for Politico magazine, and he had a wonderful and fascinating article in today's Politico magazine, said, which describes what it was like to be on Air Force One during that day of 9/11. And the article is called "We're the Only Plane in the Sky." I urge you to read that. And then coming up, Brandon Del Pozo, he's the chief of the Burlington Police Department. He was a police officer in Lower Manhattan that day, and then former Lieutenant Governor Brian Doobie. He helped in the recovery efforts at Ground Zero for the Air Force. But on the line right now is Justin Duckham from Talk Media News. Justin, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Great to be here.
Great. I want to ask you this because we are covering 9/11/2001 right now. Be interested. You're fairly young. Where were you and what were you doing during 9/11?
I was actually a freshman in high school back then. And I was on the West Coast in California, so it was a little bit later when the news broke over there. I guess my immediate memory is my dad running into my room. He had just woken up and was, you know, not to embarrass him, was actually still in his underwear, and went to the base of my bed and kind of shook it in shock to wake me up and, yelled that the World Trade Center was gone or something along those lines, and then ran back downstairs. It didn't really strike me as a 14-year-old who had never really been to New York, who didn't really know much about the East Coast, and probably, frankly, didn't really know what the World Trade Center was beyond a throwaway Simpsons joke that I had seen a couple years prior. So so it took a while for it to sink in. And, you know, I recall going to school that day and just understanding as the morning developed the sheer magnitude of what was going on. And, you know, I guess I also distinctly remember the ride to school. My dad and I would always listen to the radio together, and just hearing the, you know, flurry of news reports that were coming out, a lot of, you know, information that ended up not being, you know, completely accurate. We heard Willie Brown, the mayor of San Francisco, I believe at the time, or at least, you know, previously around that date, saying that, you know, the city was on alert over there, that, you know, their top concern, of course, was fear that an attack could hit the Golden Gate Bridge, and then just going on from there. So, you know, I was far away from D.C. at that point, but of course, as anybody who lived through that day, that was a pretty strong memory.
Justin, just curiosity, because, you know, there was a similar event when I was in grade school, which was the assassination of JFK. One of the things that they did, we only did a half day of school. Did you do a full day of school that day?
I did do a full day of school. It was obviously, you know, not really one that packed in a lot of information. There was sort of, you know, a period at the top of each class wherein, you know, we would either watch the news or we would, you know, talk to our teachers about their thoughts on what would happen. You know, I remember my history teacher, David Homa, who I usually will contact every day on the anniversary of 9/11 just to talk about, who, you know, really kind of talked us through the crisis, you know, who discussed what would possibly come next, what impact it would have on the economy, and was really kind of a soothing presence for a lot of students that day who were really looking to their teachers for some kind of guidance as, you know, the world seemed to fall apart.
What do you, as a kid, I'm just curious, could you understand the magnitude of this?
You know, I could, I guess. I didn't understand the full magnitude until you know, a couple hours into the day. But, you know, my dad's a pretty, you know, measured guy by most accounts. So the fact that he was sort of running around the house in a panic was, you know, sort of an indicator that this was, you know, a much bigger deal than, you know, some of those, you know, faraway accounts of national tragedies taking place that, you know, give concern and whatnot. But, yeah, I mean, this was something that certainly, you know, defined our youth. And in the months after was certainly, you know, something that really kind of, you know, defined, I guess, my teenage years to a large extent. You know, I was in the punk rock scene, which was pretty critical of, you know, U.S. Foreign policy and whatnot. You know, I was politically engaged to a relatively, you know, big extent in the sense that I was kind of a snotty-nosed, you know, liberal punk rock kid and whatnot. And so the impact of that and just kind of following the developments that came after, I guess, sort of defined me politically as well.
Hey, Justin, some other day we'll talk about North Korea. Some other day we'll talk about politics. I want to sort of keep this reserved to 9/11. I thank you for your reflections.
Thank you so much. You have a good one.
Justin Duckham, Talk Media News. Coming up, Brandon Del Pozo, the chief of the Burlington Police Department. We'll talk about what he was doing on that day, on 9/11/2001, as a New York City police officer in Lower Manhattan. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Today on Open Mic, it's dedicated to 9/11/2001, and we spoke in the first hour with Garrett Graff, who described the events. It's from an article he wrote in Politico magazine today that describes the events on Air Force One. But now we're turning our attention to what was happening on the ground in New York City, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the Open Mic show Brandon Del Pozo, chief of the Burlington Police Department, but more importantly for this discussion, he was a police officer in the New York City Police Department during 9/11/2001. Good morning, Chief Del Pozo.
Hey, good morning, Mike. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you for coming on. Can you describe where you were and what you were doing the morning of 9/11?
Yeah, it seems like it was so long ago. I was a patrol cop in the 6-7 precinct, which is a precinct in East Flatbush, Brooklyn. A big Caribbean American community, so I was one of those guys that you'd see riding around in a patrol car. I had a partner named Kevin Burke. So, you know, we used to answer 911 calls in our cruiser, and you know, we were actually sent to get breakfast for the bosses at the precinct that day. And as we were coming back with the food, which we had to get back because they, if you deliver a New York City sergeant, you know, a cold egg sandwich, you're in big trouble. So we're driving north on the avenue, and we see off in the distance this beautiful blue sky, but there's a really thick stream of black smoke cutting across it. And our first reaction was, what type of person runs an incinerator on a day like today? But of course, it wasn't an incinerator. It was the plane.
And the first plane that hit the tower, many people thought it was an accident. Is that what the impression that many people in New York had?
Yeah, of course. So we first thought it was a small plane or some sort of mishap or a sightseeing plane. And we knew that anything that happens in that part of Manhattan that's of note is going to require a pretty big police response for traffic and crowd control and security. They were calling for mobilization. And our first thought, we were studying to be sergeants. It takes a tremendous amount of studying to pass that test. And we thought, you know, as just kind of jaded, you know, street cops, oh, man, this is going to interfere with our plans to study after work because we're going to get called into the city. And we only said that because we thought it was some person, you know, some incautious pilot crashing a small plane into the World Trade Center, something that was like well beyond our control and not really relevant to what we were doing in Brooklyn. Of course, we were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We found that out pretty quickly. But we brought back the food, and the desk sergeant said, you know, turn in your cruiser keys and get in the van. You guys are going downtown. And right as he said that, you know, around that time, the second plane had hit, and we knew this was an attack.
And it was at that point you knew it was an attack. What happened from there? You were headed downtown. What did you see? Where did you go?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about that day is it really was just, ordinary New Yorkers and Americans, from the plane that went down in Philadelphia at the hands of the passengers and crew to the officers and firemen and citizens who were evacuating the towers. It was just people really reacting as heroically as they could to an overwhelming situation that they had absolutely no warning about. So, I mean, I did what thousands of cops did. We went downtown. We did a great job as a police department of shutting down the highways in a way that gave really fast access into the city. So we were driving, northbound in the southbound lanes, basically, because of a traffic plan that we sprung into effect as a police department. And I remember cresting over the height of land on the BQE. There was a man off his motorcycle just gazing at the towers. You know, we've all seen that image. And then I went down into the Battery Tunnel, and that was the last time I ever saw the towers intact.
Mm. When you came out, what was your responsibility?
Yeah, so this was sort of how fate plays its hand. You know, normally a cop drives, rank of police officer, but today it was a sergeant, just because of the chaos. And he just got behind the wheel, which is not how they do it in New York. And we're all telling him, listen, when you get out of the tunnel, make a right. That's the towers. You know, we had heard people were jumping. We knew that there was an evacuation that was going on. And you would think, you know, get out and make a right and go to where you're needed. I mean, and he said no. On the other side of the, like around the horn of Manhattan, there's a place where we're going to get our assignment. It's by this, used to be a Pathmark parking lot where cops would mobilize, but now it's condos. So we're like, no, why are you going to go around the horn and get the assignment to be told to come right back here or just make the right? But the sergeant behind the wheel made the left. And we got our assignment from a guy with a clipboard, a lieutenant, and we were tasked with evacuating the New York Stock Exchange. So I don't know what would have happened if we made the right. I mean, we would have done what so many people did, I think, which is run into that building and try to help people, and our fate would have been very uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, we were a few blocks away, shutting down the Stock Exchange and evacuating that, because that was considered a target as well.
Chief, were the towers down at that point?
No, they weren't. They were up. They were up probably, time is hard to measure, but for 45 minutes at least, I think, from the time we got that assignment, maybe a little less. So no, they weren't.
So when did you realize the towers were coming down?
Yeah, I mean, when there was this ear-splitting roar, we weren't far, in front of the exchange, and everybody started running, and debris started falling, and this big cloud of dust started closing in. So I started running, and so before the dust cloud came, and it was just a roar, I really thought that there was a jet engine coming at us. It's what it sounded like. It was deafening. And I said, I don't know where I'm running from. I don't know where I'm running to. Where am I running? And then when the debris started coming down, and it wasn't a big, it was smaller debris and smoke, I got really scared because I'd been in some fires as a cop. And I know how caustic they were and how they could kill you. And I said, if that smoke is like the smoke from a fire, we're all going to die. But it wasn't. It was the pulverized concrete. And I ran into the stock exchange. And then there was a TV on, a cable TV on in the lobby of this exit to the stock exchange that was filming from New Jersey. So it was filming the tower collapsing. And I was watching it from in the cloud that was being filmed from New Jersey. It was like a little surreal. And I realized before I'd do anything else, you know, there were people crying, there were people collapsed. I just called my wife and my parents because there was a landline. All the cell phones were flooded. I just said, listen, I'm down in that cloud. I'm alive. So that's all I have right now. You know, everybody stay safe. And that's where I knew the tower, the first tower had fallen.
Mm-hmm. And the second tower. Were you in that same vicinity, too, when that came down?
Yeah. You know, so my last known orders were to evacuate the stock exchange. So, and my sergeant had run in one direction, and there was very little supervision. I was like a, you know, I was a young lieutenant in the National Guard. So I just said, you know, those were my orders. The first thing I did was went to look for my partner because I lost him. And I went out in the cloud searching for him. I posted, there was a police cadet who got mobilized. I put him at the door to the stock exchange with a flashlight and said, anybody walking through the cloud, you can pull into here. It's safe. I went down into the subway, told the token booth clerk, shut the subway down. Where, you know, subway's done for today. And then I went back, and so I finally located my partner, and there was like a little hallway that led to a part of the floor of the stock exchange where maybe 100 people had sheltered. And I stood up on a folding chair, and it was an interesting time because these are all, like, you know, wealthy. I mean, these are traders and stockbrokers. And I remember somebody in the background was talking, and then an old man with blue eyes and gray hair and like, a really nice suit said, this cop is going to tell us something. Everybody's going to shut up and listen. And it really hit me how important, you know, the work of the police was that day. And I was a young guy. I mean, and I was standing on a folding chair, and I explained how we were going to evacuate. And I told folks, we're going to, if the first tower went down, then the second one is probably going to go down too, and we're going to wait till it does, and then once that clears, everybody's going to go over the Brooklyn Bridge and get out of Manhattan. And I was just kind of making that up because I had a set of orders and I was trying to figure out how to make them, how to fulfill them.
And is that what happened?
Yeah, that's what happened. I mean, that was pretty much went according to plan, and then we spent the rest of the day downtown. I think we were so frustrated. There was so little we can do. One thing that's poignant about being here in Vermont is, you know, we looked up and saw these fighter planes, and it was such a sense of relief to see those planes. I didn't know they were from the Vermont Guard, but I was very touched when I got here and learned that they were, because we said, finally, I mean, I don't know what decisions those pilots would have had to have made mm-hmm. if there was other planes coming in, but at least we knew they had our back. We didn't have to worry about being killed from the sky. We could concentrate on trying to help people on the ground. And, you know, when I hear the noise of those jets, whether it's at the air show or in the afternoons, it's never a negative thing. It reminds me about the day that Vermont came to help us. That's my opinion on that.
Is there one thing that strikes you about that day that you still remember?
Officer Moira Smith was one of the NYPD officers who died that day. She came down from the 13th Precinct, and her last gasps literally were made into police radio, and people didn't... she sounded like Minnie Mouse, and I say that because she was under the rubble and couldn't breathe and had this really, really, really high-pitched voice, and somebody said into the radio, hey, stop joking. This is sick. But they didn't know it. I mean, they wouldn't expect a cop to sound like that. It was her just trying to get some help before she died. I'll never forget that. And everything that fell at your feet. I mean, there was all those lives, all those people's work lives up in the towers. There was a huge phone book that was up there somewhere on the 100th floor or whatever, and one tiny page of it fell at my feet. And I realized that thing was a phone book up there, complete, even a few hours ago. What must have happened up there to just get one page? But then photos of families were falling at our feet, old paychecks, a doll, that there was, you know, people's cubicle lives and office lives and family lives were all contained in those buildings, and they all came raining down, and you couldn't take a step without passing something that was part of someone's life, and you were just assuming they were all gone.
Chief Del Pozo, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. That is Chief Brandon Del Pozo, Chief of the Burlington Police Department, but more importantly, he was a young officer in the New York City Police Department during 9/11. Coming up, former Lieutenant Governor Brian Duby about what he was doing at Ground Zero in the recovery effort at the Twin Towers. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Of course, today's program is dedicated exclusively to 9/11/2001. We've spoken with Brandon Del Pozo, the chief of the Burlington Police Department, who was a young New York City police officer at the time. We've also had a fascinating interview with Garrett Graff, former editor of Politico magazine, and wrote a fascinating piece this morning in Politico magazine called "We're the Only Plane in the Sky," and it's talking about Air Force One. I urge you to read that article, but it's my pleasure right now to welcome to the Open Mic Show former Lieutenant Governor Brian Duby, who had duties at Ground Zero with the recovery effort as a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force Reserve. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Brian, could you describe where you were and what you were doing the morning of 9/11?
Yeah, I was actually at work at Logan, and I was flying to Dallas that morning. My co-pilot was at the jet. And I was just wrapping up the paperwork and just in the process of actually stepping to my flight that I don't recall the exact time, but I think my takeoff time was like 9:30, 9:25. So that's where I was, Mike.
And when did you know that something was amiss that morning?
Yeah, was I was in those days, we could actually walk from operations right to the jet. So I was literally walking out the door onto the ramp to walk to my jet. And I met, we have a very small office in Logan, but we have a chief pilot and a head administrator. And I met the administrator walking in, and she looked at me and she said, "I need your help. They've got Captain John Oganowski's airplane." And, you know, I didn't know what she was talking about, obviously, but I proceeded to do what I was asked, and we went back into her office, and, you know, the events quickly evolved. Phone rang, and it was actually shortly, you know, as we witnessed the events, our operations had received a phone call from one of our flight attendants, actually on Flight 11. Flight 11 was a Boston-originated flight, and it was scheduled for a transcon. It was a 767, and a captain that I had a particular respect for, Captain John Oganowski. I'd been his co-pilot for 10 years. Was the captain on that day, So that's kind of where it started for me, Mike.
So when you realized that American Airlines had some aircraft that were hijacked, what happens in that sort of situation? Did everything come to a halt at Logan?
Well, you know, so it's. The rules were rewritten back in the day. Hijacking, you know, in that time, the official briefings as a part of our training was always cooperate with hijackers.
Mm-hmm.
That was the guidance. It was, you know, tried to delay and to pacify and, you know, and to be cooperative. So, you know, that's not what happened that day. There was box cutters and forced entry into the cockpit, and my coworkers were murdered, literally. And obviously the other horrible events happened. But it's hard to say, you know, what the standard procedure was and what happened that day, Mike. But obviously I remember talking to my dispatcher in Dallas, and he said, "No, you're scheduled to go." And I said, "Hey, I don't know what's going on, but I can tell you one thing. I'm not flying to Dallas. You're going to get some news pretty quick." So, you know, the rule book was, the procedures were rewritten that day, Mike.
Soon after that day, your role changed and you were assigned to New York City. What was your role in New York City?
Yeah, so as a reservist, I had flown F-4s and F-16s in a Vermont Guard for 20 years, and I, about a year previous to 9/11. I transferred into the Air Force Reserve. And my job was to support the active duty Air Force and be a liaison to the state of Vermont. As soon as the event started to unfold in 9/11, I was asked by the company to go spend the morning with Captain John Oganowski's wife, Peggy, who was actually a flight attendant for American, and their three daughters. And then I was asked by the Air Force Reserve to report to FEMA Region 1, which is the FEMA headquarters. It happens to be located pretty close to where Captain Oganowski lived, in Maynard, Mass. It's a regional operations center. And what some people remember, I just heard your interview with our chief, Brandon. He did an outstanding job, just to hear that. But he'll know the FEMA region that should have had the operational control was actually destroyed during when the towers came down. So FEMA Region 2 transferred operational control to FEMA Region 1, and that's where I reported to on the afternoon of September 11th. And we coordinated the federal response, Mike.
And what did that involve, Brian? Was that, when you say coordinating the federal response, what does that mean? You were probably coordinating the military federal response.
Well, I was in a FEMA region headquarters, so my job was to represent the Air Force on a FEMA team. And specifically for, obviously there was a lot of personnel, firefighters, first responders in New York City. But one challenge that I got involved in early on was, if you imagine New York City, you cut it into five pieces of a pie, they had thousands of first responders. They had nowhere near, they didn't have the ability or the bandwidth to communicate via their radios for those thousands of responders. So a heads-up planner quickly put together, divided the 9/11, the footprint, into five pieces, and he had a frequency plan. And one mission that I got involved with that was a critical mission, as described to me, was there was a Motorola factory in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and they pre-programmed within hours, I don't know if it was 10,000 radios, but thousands of radios in accordance with a plan that was put together by the city of New York. And I happened to, being a former guard guy, I happened to know the people in Jacksonville, Florida, the Florida Air National Guard, and I knew they had an airplane. And I made a phone call early on, and I said, we need you to fly your C-130 to Fort Lauderdale and pick up two pallets of radios, and we need you to fly them to New York. And I was met with some kind of questions about whose authority, and I said, here's my Social Security number. You can put my name down. I'll please launch that airplane. And they did. They flew all night. They landed in New York City on, I think it was Wednesday morning. And I later met with people in New York City when I, on Thursday morning, I was, after they stood up another operational control center, I actually reported there, and I was met with a lot of gratitude for, you know, the Air Force. That was one thing that the Air Force could do to help the professionals, the people really doing the heavy lifting in New York City were the first responders. But, you know, that was one thing that, as a federal partner, we were able to assist them. And they're the heroes. They're the ones who did the work. But obviously, you know, we played a little supporting role to help them with something that they needed.
One of the things that happens in a large event like this is trying to maintain command and control, especially at the incident center. Was there confusion in the sort of the early hours of this, of how to get back command and control?
Well, I think, you know, I'd be candid to say, yeah, I think there was confusion. I mean, they had a federal response. But there was, you know, this is kind of new ground. Brandon talked about the plume. I mean, there was a lot of uncertainty about the effect of the plume. There was a lot of, you know, it started out to be a rescue response, rescuing people that were trapped, and then sadly it quickly evolved into more of a recovery operation, Mike, which is, you know, the fact that there weren't going to be many people that were going to be saved in the response. So Yeah, it was obviously a dynamic situation, and there was a lot of very difficult decisions that had to be made in a timely fashion. But as we all learned, it quickly became a recovery operation, Mike.
Going back to the search and rescue for just a moment, one of the things that was needed in at least the first hours or first days was search and rescue assets. You talked about the radios, but also search and rescue assets, including search and rescue teams. Were you involved at all in bringing in search and rescue teams and assets?
Well, that's another area that, you know, obviously first the firefighters were the heroes. Mm-hmm. The police department supporting them were the heroes. But as you mentioned, today, as we speak, there are, I think the number is 70 urban search and rescue teams that are specifically trained and have dogs that are trained, that are standing by across the world, but in the United States. And one of the things that we did early on, within hours of the, the Air Force One wasn't the only plane flying, because we had cargo planes that were transporting preloaded, prepacked urban search and rescue teams. I think over the course of the events, 70 urban search and rescue teams that are literally standing by, and they're standing by mostly for earthquake recovery, but they're also trained, in this situation, they're training fit very well. And one of our Air Force missions was to transport via air urban search and rescue teams into New York to help the first responders in that recovery effort.
When did you finally get to Ground Zero?
Mike, I was trying to remember the exact. I think it was the evening of Thursday afternoon. So this happened Tuesday. We worked through the night Tuesday night at Maynard, and when they set up a alternate command post on Thursday, they asked the people from some of us from FEMA Region 1 from Maynard to report to New York, and so we reported. The team that I was working with, we reported on Thursday afternoon, and the first place we were taken to was Ground Zero, Mike.
What was your first thought when you saw Ground Zero?
I was shocked. I mean, just revulsion, the carnage, the fact that my friends, aircraft was in the midst of that wreckage, and flight attendants and the air crew that I had flown with, were somehow mixed into that wreckage, but. My reaction was similar to anyone else who saw the pile, just revulsion, Mike.
Reflecting back, what strikes you about 9/11?
A couple things, Mike. The need to be vigilant. If you're in positions of responsibility, you're the chief of a local fire department, you're the chief of a police department, maybe you work for FEMA, maybe you're in elected office, the need to be vigilant. That's one reaction. The other is maybe the lack of understanding between two cultures that results in a terrible event like that, Mike, is another reaction.
How did you find the people of New York when you arrived?
I have very, very fond memories of reminiscing the people in the hotels, the New Yorkers that I interacted with. One thing Brandon just mentioned, talking to my friends that were actually flying CAP over the city, I do remember making one phone call to General Bill Etter at the time, and I said, the Vermont Air Guard, my former squadron mates, were flying at about 5,000 feet, and I made a phone call and I said, hey, it's very reassuring to see the Vermont Air Guard overhead, and the population is very grateful, but I think you should bump the air cap up at least to 10,000 feet, 15,000 feet, because people are still, and this was Thursday, people are still traumatized by the events, and that was feedback that was welcome and acted upon. But no, the people were so gracious. I've never seen such unity as an American of what I saw in New York City. I cherish that memory of the unity, and it gives me hope of what we could be, what we have been as a country, And that's a feeling, that unity, that solidarity, the empathy for fellow citizens that I will long cherish, Mike.
Finally, Brian, did 9/11 have an impact on you professionally and personally?
Well, obviously professionally. I have a 28-year career as a commercial airline pilot, and I took my job very seriously. Me and my coworkers took our jobs very seriously pre-9/11. We certainly understand, you know, it's a job. It could be a career of mostly boredom punctuated by sheer terror, and you have to be vigilant. You have to never to be complacent in aviation. So that's a professional impact. Complacency is not a word that anybody in aviation can afford. Personally, you know, as a father and a husband, you know, I would, you know, life is short, life is precious. We never really know what's going to happen. And so personally, maybe a more sense of urgency, a more, you know, feeling of don't take the good times for granted, Mike.
Brian Doobie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for, you know, asking these difficult questions to, you know, remember this important part of our history.
Thank you, Brian. That's Brian Doobie, former lieutenant governor, and was a recovery officer at Ground Zero during the days right after 9/11. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Today we're remembering the single deadliest terror attack in history, where approximately 3,000 people died and 6,000 people were injured. Of course, it's the 15th anniversary of September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks. Got about 10 minutes. Open up the phone lines for your calls, 802-244-1777, or toll free at 877-291-8255. If you've got a recollection, if you've got a comment, give us a call. We've had a program dedicated today to September 11th, 2001. And the reason we've had that today is that we don't broadcast on Sunday, so we're having the recollection, the remembrance today. Let's go to Bill in Randolph. Bill, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Oh, hi. I had a couple questions. For Brandon Del Pusso, I would have asked him about the 47-story Building 7 that collapsed in a perfect controlled demolition in 7 seconds. And, of course, the towers came down in less than 12 seconds in a different, unusual controlled demolition.
Bill, get off my phone. Get off my phone. Don't ever do this conspiracy stuff with me. Get off my phone. Rob, North Carolina, what say you?
Hey, Mike, as he was talking, I was just thinking, come on, we've got to get away from this, because as you were saying the word conspiracy, I was thinking another conspiracy story about to erupt on Mike's show, and I was just thinking, I don't think Mike's going to like this, and I'm glad you did what you did. This is no time for that. We want unity, Mike. And if 9/11 showed anything in those early months, was that we can unite as a country, Mike. And we must unite as a country. We are the greatest still yet. We're slipping some, but we're the greatest nation in defending of freedom, liberty, free speech. We can't let this go. I mean, it's been said, and maybe it sounds trite to some people, but we are the bastion of freedom in the world. We are a beacon. That's why we have immigrants flooding into this country like no other country, Mike. And I get it why they're coming, okay? Because we will stand firm.
Thanks, Rob, for your phone call. Let's go to Bill and Barry. Bill, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. What this tells me is, and what you just said, and Rob just said, is that people stuck together. I want to say where I was during both this 9/11 and September 7th, 1941, when I was 10 years old. I was in the dining room in both cases. Actually, when I was here, I was waiting on the telephone to talk to Mark Johnson. That didn't happen. But everybody pulled together. Now, on December 7th, my father was already in the service, and we were in the dining room, and he got a call from his headquarters And they told him not to come in until Monday. They had plenty to do on Monday. Let's not have more confusion. But what I really want to say is I had an uncle, his youngest brother, who was in his 40s, way beyond draft age. And that week, he joined the Marines. He went through boot camp, was put in the Seabees, and spent the war in the Pacific. Off of Okinawa, his LST was hit by a kamikaze. He survived and joked about it. Now, there was millions of people, thousands and millions of people, then that pulled together for the country just like they did after 9/11.
Thanks, Bill, for your phone call. Obviously, a lot of people also joined the military after 9/11 trying to help this country, and we appreciate their service. What we're doing in the last few minutes of Open Mic today is remembering the single deadliest terrorist attack in our history, where 3,000 people died, 6,000 people were injured, over 6,000 people were injured, and sort of reflecting on your thoughts about that day. Let's go to Matt in Hinesburg. Matt, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Hi there. Yeah, I think that I wish I'd gotten to talk to Brian Doobie, but I believe there was some kind of autopilot, a brand new autopilot technology so that those planes could land themselves.
Hmm. Yeah, I haven't heard about that, Matt, but that would be interesting if that were the case. And certainly somebody trying to fly an airplane into buildings or into the ground being overridden by something else that's being controlling. In some sense, that's a little scary, too. I mean, that if that is true, that would be a little scary. Look, our reflections on Sunday should be about remembering those that died in these attacks as well. And we shouldn't forget this. As well as those who died or were killed in conflicts as a result of 9/11, particular Afghanistan and Iraq, The greatest respect we can give these victims is the simple act of remembering them. And in the beginning, I talked about all the changes that we've gone through since 9/11. Think about it. Not only at the airport, but in our security, in terms of our intelligence security. You know, it was kind of scary after 9/11. It was eerie after 9/11. In the sky, there weren't aircraft, except military aircraft. It was quiet. And one of the things that we realized after 9/11 is that we no longer could be oblivious to what was happening in other parts of the world. That perhaps was the biggest change of 9/11. Because events that were happening in other parts of the world directly affected us. And when we looked at that pile of burning rubble in New York City, we were reminded just how vulnerable we were to attacks. I want to make sure that we do honor those people. And we had two of those people on the show today. We honor those people that helped out right after 9/11. Especially our first responders. Chief Del Pozo being one of them. But many who did not make it out of those Twin Towers when they collapsed. And also the passengers on United Flight 93. Think what they did. They knew what was going on. From cell phones, they knew what was going on. And yet to save hundreds, perhaps even thousands, because that plane was headed for either the Capitol or the White House, they rushed the cockpit of that plane. And as a result, it crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. We also can't forget the Pentagon. We've talked about the Twin Towers. We've talked about Shanksville, Pennsylvania. But the Pentagon was hit as well. the Pentagon. And a lot of people never thought we would see the day that we would see the Pentagon burning. So the question is, are we safer? And that's up for debate. And we'll discuss that in different shows at different times. But right now, I want to thank all the guests today. Garrett Graff, former editor of Politico magazine, for his piece called "We're the Only Plane in the Sky." I urge you to go online to Politico magazine, Politico magazine, and read this. It is it's long, but it's a fascinating piece about Air Force One during 9/11. I also want to thank Brandon Del Pozo, chief of the Burlington Police Department. What a moving sort of discussion we had about what was going on at Ground Zero. And then Lieutenant Governor Brian Doobie, not only an American airline pilot who lost a friend, but also somebody that helped in the recovery effort. Thank you for your phone calls. I really do appreciate them. This is Open Mic, and you're listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 from Warren, 96.5 from Barrie, and 98.3 AM FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you all for your phone calls. Have a great weekend, and remember those that lost their lives on 9/11 and those who paid the ultimate sacrifice later. And we'll talk again on Tuesday.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.